Welcome back to the Bitcoin Layer. I'm Nick Bhatia. Today, we welcome Damian Schott. Damian has joined the Bitcoin Layer this year as a research analyst, and he is also the founder of the USC Bitcoin Club, where I am an adjunct professor. Now, Damian is also an economics student at USC, and he has a lot of questions about markets as he's joined the team. So, Damian, why don't you introduce people to yourself? And then we're going to get into some of your questions about economics.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here. As I've been studying economics, I've noticed that there is some of the things I learned contradict what I learned from Bitcoin. And I'm very curious about this. At USC, I wanted to learn more about Bitcoin, so I've started the Bitcoin Club. And with the goal of really just bringing students into an environment where they can learn about Bitcoin from peers and also hear from professors and professionals in the field.
That's excellent. And so, Damian, what we want to do here is you've been asking me questions in our own, you know, TBL environment, and I thought it would be excellent to bring those questions to the viewer and the listener, because there's, I find that when I'm teaching somebody and speaking to somebody, that the material sometimes is more genuine than if I'm just speaking to the camera and trying to teach people at home. So that's really the purpose of this type of conversation here. So why don't you ask your first question about Bitcoin and how it relates to traditional economics?
Awesome. Well, one of the main takeaways from my traditional economics classes is I've learned that certain amounts of inflation for currency is a good thing, but this seems to contradict Bitcoin, which is inherently deinflationary. And the reason why inflation to me is told to be a good thing is because it incentivizes people to not hold dollars and to instead invest their money. And then this helps grow the economy because people invest into businesses by buying stocks, and that helps companies grow, or they buy real estate that supports property values. But my question is, how could a hard money like Bitcoin be viewed as beneficial if it could be promoting people to save or hoard their money instead of spending it in the economy?
This is a really great question. And there's probably an entire hour episode that we could do just breaking down some of these answers. So let's try to start from the economic student's perspective. Okay. That's where you're coming from. The topic of inflation, whether it is good or not good. So there is a school of thought that believes that inflation is wholly and entirely a monetary phenomenon. And I've been thinking about QE versus the great inflation of 2020, 2021 that we had. Okay. QE started in 2009-10 and continued in its form for about 6 years. QE is what? It's expansion of the central bank's balance sheet. And therefore, it is an expansion of what people consider base money. But we didn't have inflation. We didn't have above target inflation, let's just say, from 2010 to 2015. We had good asset returns, but we didn't have consumer price inflation that was 3%. So why did that not happen with QE if the monetary system expanded very much so during those years? Okay, that's one question that I want to pose. Now, remember that what I said, the first thing, inflation is a monetary phenomenon. It means what? It means that inflation can only happen when money grows. That is my approach here. Now, if the monetary system grew during QE, but we didn't get inflation, then what happened? So let's talk about what happened in 2020 and 2021. Why did we get inflation with that round of QE, but not the other round in 2010 to 2015? Any thoughts, Damian? What is the reason we got inflation in 2020, but we didn't get it in 2010, even though the QE was in both places? And The incorrect answer is that it was more QE. That's not the right answer. Okay. There was more QE in 2020, but it's not the right answer. Any thoughts?
Well, 2020 was during the pandemic, so there wasn't any more productivity, I assume. We were just injecting, we were handing out stimulus checks.
That's the answer. It's the stimulus check. So it's fiscal expansion and deficit, expansion of debt, which means large deficits. The large, extremely large deficits were coupled by QE. So the inflation being a monetary phenomenon in 2020 is what? Expansion of the US government's balance sheet by printing more treasury instruments. And just because you're issuing more debt doesn't mean that there's more money in the system, but there is when it is spent. And that's what the stimulus checks did. It spent the monetary expansion at the government. And that government monetary expansion, a lot of the debt went where? Onto the balance sheet of the
government.
The Fed, right? The Fed, when the Fed does QE, the Fed buys treasuries from the private market. The private market absorbs treasuries as the government borrows and spends. So the Fed plus the government created the inflation in 2020 and 2021. So it's a monetary phenomenon because the bank balance sheet expanded. Why did the bank balance sheet expand? That's the other part of it here, is that back to square one, inflation is caused by money growth. So if QE doesn't technically grow money, then only because the Fed can't technically grow money, then only the banks can technically grow money. Because what is M2? You know what M2 is? What does it consist of? This is a monetary measure, a measure that the financial system uses, not so much anymore, but one that that's used to measure the size of the financial system. What is M2 actually measuring?
Isn't it the money supply? Is it because the banks lend out money? The whole concept of fractional reserve banking?
It's the asset side is the lending, Damien. The asset side is the lending. But M2 measures liabilities. So what it's actually measuring are the deposits.
Okay.
So when a bank lends money, if I'm Wells Fargo and I lend money to you, let's say a small business loan, I lend you $100,000. You come in, you apply for the loan, and I say the loan is granted. And I say it's $100,000. The next day, what happens? You wake up, you check your Wells Fargo app, and what does it say? You have a brand new checking account, I assume. What does it say? You have what?
I have that $100,000.
$100,000. So that is a deposit for you. It's your money. It's your deposit. It's their liability. So they have expanded their balance sheet. Small business loan on the asset side goes up by $100,000 and deposit goes up by $100,000. And the whole system has grown because you had a business idea.
Okay.
Okay. So money gets created when you have a business idea and Wells Fargo says yes. That is brand new money that never existed before. And so why do we at the Bitcoin layer measure liquidity? We do it asset side, which is different than measuring deposits, but many people measure M2, the size of deposits. Why do they say that money growth or M2 causes, let's say, stocks to go up? Why do people correlate money growth with stock prices? Go back to your example of you just borrowed $100,000. Now you have $100,000. So why does it make stocks go up?
Well, it's just more liquidity that can go into the stock market.
Because there's a chance that you're going to take $10,000 and put it in the stock market. You're not going to spend $100,000 today. You're going to invest it wisely. You're going to hire somebody. You're going to buy some capital good, some technology equipment, something. You're going to spend it. maybe you'll put some of it in savings and put some of it in stocks. And then when you spend that $10,000 on a hiring bonus, the person that you hired might take that 10 grand and do what? Put it in stocks. So you having your business idea and going to Wells Fargo is actually fuel for the stock market. That's what the liquidity concept is all about, because it's brand new money. It's firepower for asset prices. So ask your follow-up. Yeah.
Well, I'm just wondering, so institutions, so they're basically, they're measuring the amount of liquidity and then they're investing in stocks, just not based off of other people investing in stocks, but just based off of the like expanding liquidity, because they're like, oh, well, it's now possible for them to fuel.
So this is what you're asking is about models. So at TBL, we have TBL liquidity, right? It's a model. It means it measures the banking system. We do asset side. So we're measuring the size of the banking system and we're layering in interest rates and bond volatility and showing as a model, here's how much firepower. That's what I like to think about TBL liquidity. It's that monetary firepower that the banking system has to just go create more money to buy stocks. They don't have to be the ones buying stocks, but they know somebody is going to. So your question is about asset managers. Are asset managers just looking at liquidity going up and saying, this is the reason that we should buy stocks? Or are they, is it a trailing phenomenon, meaning new money is created, then that new money goes up and buys stocks, then the stock market goes up and the asset managers look at that and say, oh, there's correlation. So maybe the trend is with us, so we should get long. That is a circular question that I don't think we need to answer. Okay. So, but what I want you to understand is that if new money makes the stock market go up because somebody buys it, what that means is that smart asset managers are probably looking at monetary measures to make investment decisions. And take that one step further, the Bitcoin layer, in our effort to be value add to our readers, viewers, and listeners, we said, hey, we should be measuring liquidity in our own way because we think that will help people with their investment decisions, or at least explain what's going on in stocks and Bitcoin. And we don't, claiming that we have the crystal ball now that we have our own metric, that's a suicide mission. We're not going to do that. If you look at just the basic M2 with the stock market, there was a good chart that I saw online. It had monetary growth, but just M2, so bank deposits basically, trailing with the stock market, and basically 3 months after M2 goes up, stocks go up. So that fits your part of your question, which is it just people getting new money and buying stocks with it in a few months after they get it? And the answer is probably yes. And then are asset managers trying to model that and make investment decisions based on that? Probably yes. But don't get too bogged down in the circular of who's doing what first. It's the theory, the theoretical approach that I think is important to get across, that new money causes asset prices to go up. And therefore, we should be thinking about new money and everything that that has to do. And so that's why we watch the Fed. We watch balance sheet activity, and we watch what the banks are doing. And we watch the government now, because we understand, we have a better understanding today than when 3 years ago, of what impact the government can have when it does stimulus checks, right? That moves the needle clearly more than QE did. And it took us a decade and a half of empirical data, because we never got that round of stimulus plus QE until 2020. So there's new evidence, and we learned from our mistakes. And now we know to watch the fiscal situation a lot more closely. With today's macro landscape, many people are worried that they are not saving enough for retirement. Now you can grow your retirement savings with a tax-advantaged Bitcoin IRA using Unchained. The Unchained IRA is the only solution that allows you to hold your own private keys in an IRA vehicle. Right now, Unchained is running an amazing deal for you guys where you can get started with their IRA for no setup fees and no fees for the first year. You can roll over traditional IRAs or other 401k accounts into this new Unchained IRA, and they can help you set up everything. Go to unchained.com/TBL and experience true ownership over your retirement.
Mm-hmm. So you can have QE without inflation. So tying this back to Bitcoin, could you have a system with the banks that we have now, but with a hard money like Bitcoin, where you can deposit some Bitcoin into a bank, say if we ever use dollars that are backed by Bitcoin, and then the bank can go and take 90% of that, lend it to someone else, so we have like an expanding money supply in the same way?
Yes, so that is how the monetary system used to work, with fractional reserve lending and gold. So a bank, so the Federal Reserve itself had a mandated, it was 40 and then 35, I believe, percent gold coverage ratio. What that means is that the Fed's balance sheet could only be a minimum of 35% gold on the asset side. So of course it can have, you know, new loans or any other bank that has that same concept. You have a certain amount of gold on your balance sheet, then you can create new loans based off of that reserve that you actually have. And in that way, you have a fractional reserve system, so you can multiply the deposit side. So M2 can be a multiple of the total gold in the system, still fractional, but reserved by a hard money that can't necessarily be manipulated in the same way that the asset side of today's banks are. Today's banks own what on their asset side? They own bonds, and then they own loans. That's basically what they own, right? A bank is, if you think about a factory, a business that's a factory that makes stuff, right? It makes widgets. Its inventory its widgets, right? What it's produced, and then its capital is basically the machines and the building that help it to make the widgets, right? A bank doesn't have a factory. It doesn't have machines. It doesn't have widgets. It just has money. Its assets are money, and its liabilities are money, and it's just different types of money on each side. So on the asset side, it has bonds, which are a type of money, and it has loans, which are a type of money. But the way that banks are regulated these days is it's a risk-weighted asset system. So you look at all your types of money, and then you multiply them by a factor, and the sum product of all of that risk weighting is how much you're allowed to go out and lend. That's a very crude version of what it is, but that's how it works today. And you can see that if you basically manipulate what you own, then you can create a risk weighting to your own liking. And that's what banks do, that they manipulate. And I don't mean manipulate like they're scamming somebody, but they're maneuvering their balance sheet around all the time to make sure that the risk weighting is exactly what they need so they can go out. That didn't used to be the case. We used to have gold. So the answer to your question is that Bitcoin in a future fractional reserve system could be exactly as gold was, which is that you just have a Bitcoin reserve. But the problem with that in the future is that that world assumes that the Bitcoin coverage ratio will be, let's say, either regulated or uniformly agreed upon by other banks. And I think that we're very far away from that type of environment. More likely is to have every bank have their own credit worthiness be judged by the market with different deposit rates. And that's this idea of like a free market for deposits. See, because everybody in the United States gets a similar deposit rate to their neighbor because all banks are basically pegged to Fed funds because of arbitrage, and the FDIC bailout mechanism means that there's very little differentiation between deposits. Right? In terms of if you, Damien, want to go open a bank account, are you studying the balance sheet of Wells and Citi to make that decision?
No, maybe no, like the same.
You're not. Nobody that you're doing. If you're now, if you're a hedge fund and you're going to do repo, bilateral repo with Citi or Goldman, you're going to do some CDS analysis. That means like a credit study on these banks because your bilateral exposure means if the bank goes away tomorrow, your derivative could be wiped out, market value. You have all sorts of exposure. Yeah, if you're a hedge fund, and I've sat on the desk with people that are going to say, hey, I want to do my repo line with Bank of America Merrill Lynch today and not Deutsche Bank because of Deutsche Bank's creditworthiness in the market right now. But that same person is not going to do any homework on which checking account to go start for their 21-year-old child. You know, that because the FDIC changed banking as a whole. It's a little plug here for my second book. A lot of these topics are going to be in there. We're talking about how in deposit insurance changed our behavior as consumers when it comes to banks. But the point here is that you don't think about the credit worthiness between these two banks. And why is that the case? Because there is no risk, there's no difference. If Citi went down tomorrow and you made the decision to bank at Citi today and Citi went down tomorrow, it wouldn't really affect your life. You'd get your money back. You'd get it back pretty quickly. You'd start a new checking account and you would be on your way. So the point is that these banks, when these banks are expanding their balance sheet and lending money, those new deposits all have the same interest rate as each other because of this utility dynamic. If you were doing your homework and had to study which bank to put your deposit in, it would mean that there's a free market and there wouldn't be bailouts, there wouldn't be FDIC. And therefore, you might get 6% at a bank that isn't so safe and 4% at a safe bank. And then you'll have to make that decision. Do I want to play a little risk here and get the extra 2% or not? And that would be a free market, Damien. But we don't have that in banking deposits explicitly. We have it in capital markets somewhat. But you should think about why banks don't have different deposit rates. It's because we don't really have free banking. It's because we have regulated banking. Now, in this particular moment, I'm not going to say that regulated or unregulated banking is better. I'll let you explore that over time. And we can discuss that in future conversations. But I'm not here to tell you that one is better than the other. In the 1800s, we had free banking, and in the 1900s, we had regulated banking. So you have history also to go back and see which one is better and why, or to make your own judgment. So we won't go into that necessarily today, but that is really the answer to this whole like question about if fractional reserve lending were to happen on top of Bitcoin, it wouldn't really be in a overregulated environment. Okay. Therefore, the deposit rates on those bank loans reserved in part by fractional Bitcoin should theoretically have market-driven deposit rates. And you know, we're price is truth people. It means that the market rates of those deposits will give us information about the credit worthiness of the bank. That is a future Bitcoin-centric financial system that many are dreaming up. Because we have overregulation of banking, it seems far away, but it might not be as far away as some people think. And a lot of open questions here as well. Now, Damien, before you ask your next follow-up, I haven't really answered whether inflation is good or not. I want to do that first. And also the concept of hoarding, we want to hit that. So I have them written down, but I'll let you ask your next follow-up here.
Well, I'm wondering, so I've just learned from you that it's fiscal policy that really drives inflation.
It can be, right? Let's not say it is, but in the last instance, it almost certainly was, and we believe it can be a huge contributor. So I just, you know, because you're on my team, I want to make sure that you're using the exact words that, you know, I want us to be using, because assigning 100% credit to one thing in this global macro world is dangerous. We always want to make sure that we're leaving room to understand that there could have been something else there that we didn't see. See, now you and I didn't talk about supply chains shutting down. Supply chains shutting down definitely caused some inflation, right? I mean, if you can't get a product from Asia to the United States and it's not made in the United States, the price is going to go up in the United States, right? It has to. So we can't over attribute. Okay. So just wanted to nitpick there, but go ahead.
Well, now I'm wondering if there's ever another scenario similar to COVID where suddenly we have a slowdown and like maybe it's supply chain related, like as you were just saying. So prices are going up and people are spending less because of it, because there's been some crisis. And the government now can't print money to help give that to people. And I know it has long-term consequences, but in the short term, it's what the government did to alleviate some of the stresses of COVID. So if we were using a hard currency Bitcoin-backed system, what would governments do in a situation where there's an economic slowdown and they can't intervene?
Yes. So that is 1929 to 1933, and it ended up with the Franklin Roosevelt executive order to seize Bitcoin, to seize gold, and to replace it with deposits so that the government could relieve itself of the gold coverage ratio, basically get out of this trap that it only could, you know, issue a certain amount of stimulus. And so in the one century of history that we have surrounding the the gold standard to a non-gold standard era, the number one argument that traditional economists have is that you cannot have a hard cap on fractional reserve. So that means that even if you have a reserve, you can't cap the amount of new money just based off of a, you know, how much asset you have because of a crisis scenario in which you might need to or be necessitated to print or to stimulate the economy beyond what you're legally allowed to do. And so the solution to that, Damien, is free markets. So you allow the government to do whatever it does, but the market has to attribute a discount to the debt, meaning higher interest rates, right? So, but because you have this system in which that would break, I mean, we have 30 at the time, 30 trillion in debt. I don't know exactly how much it was before COVID, but I would assume somewhere in the 27, you can spot check me how much we had in 2020, somewhere in the 25 to 27 trillion in debt, Well, if you didn't manipulate interest rates down and then you ramped the debt up by $10 trillion over the next 5 years, which we did, right? We're at 36 now. If you didn't get, if you didn't manipulate interest rates down in the beginning with quantitative easing, then the $10 trillion in new debt is going to come with higher interest rates. And then the higher interest rates are going to make it very difficult for the government to afford the interest and its bills, which we, which is, by the way, it's already starting to happen because the notional debt is so large that the interest bill is over $1 trillion now, right? That's, I think, one quarter of our, all the government revenue, okay? So it's a huge amount. So if you didn't have the Fed to manipulate interest rates down, you would basically have a market result, which would be some sort of, they call it a debt spiral, but you know, it's a default type of scenario where the interest rate just goes up so much because no one's going to buy it. Then you finally get buyers, you know, if treasuries went to 10%, you would have some buyers say, okay, I'll lend the US government 10 money at 10 at 10%. But you see, Damien, here that because we live in an environment where the government can issue debt without any penalty from the market, because if it issues too much, it just nudges the Fed, right? That's kind of what happened in 2020, where the Fed and the Treasury together say, okay, this is what we're going to do to address this crisis. It's not a free market. We do not live in a free market for money at all. Money is entirely manipulated by governments and central banks. It's issued by them and manipulated, the price is manipulated by them. And the quantity of money is in a large way controlled by them, because even though banks can create new money, who makes the laws for how much money banks can create? The Fed and the government, right? Banking laws are created by Congress and banking regulations are overseen by the Fed. Mm-hmm. Which was legislated by Congress, right? Even though the Fed has independent monetary policy, they still have to go to Capitol Hill and do testimony, because they are still an agency of U.S. Congress.
So if we lived in a free market where the government could not control interest rates, you're saying the government would be just forced pretty much to stop spending because they just simply couldn't afford borrowing any more money.
Wonderfully said.
Interesting.
Because that really is what it comes down to, right? That's actually what happens to many countries around the world. That interest rate goes up and they just like, oh, we have to cut. And that's when you see the IMF, by the way, when the IMF comes in and says, oh, we're going to steal your infrastructure and if you don't pay us back. And by the way, for the loan, you also have to agree right now that you're going to cut benefits and services to your government employees. So it's like an international organization that they're like a loan shark, literally. They come in and they lend and then they set terms on you and they'll come in. They'll break your knees if you don't pay them back, and they'll just you know, seize your infrastructure. So there's a great book on this called Confessions of an Economic Hitman that I read as a young person and really shaped the way that I viewed government debt outside of the United States, and really the differentiation of treasuries and the privilege that the United States has with the way that treasuries and the dollar are used. Understanding the difference between how a country survives on a non-dollar system versus, or even a country that is on a dollar system, that's not the United States, they have a very difficult situation because they can't print their own money, right? a government that own that controls its central bank can have the central bank print money and in their own currency and get them out of jams. And you see that as well. So there's there are a lot of examples from 1929 to 1933 from the gold coverage ratio perspective. There's a lot of great examples from the 2010s with Greece and Ireland for their debt, Iceland for their debt restructuring during the financial crisis because they weren't on their own currency, right? They were on the euro. And so the euro, it's called the pigs crisis of the 20 teens. There's and then there's great examples from the last 20 years from around the world. Sri Lanka is a recent one. Argentina, El Salvador, what the IMF has done to El Salvador pre and now post Bitcoin. El Salvador might be able to kick the IMF out of their country with their profitable Bitcoin position one day. There's lots of history and things that we can apply to a maybe Bitcoin future here from this whole world.
Mm-hmm. But then the one thing I'm still trying to grasp is if the government physically, if we're in a free market with interest rates, the government physically can't spend anymore. So that's a good thing because it's not going to lead to inflation down the line. But what if there's just a really serious scenario where in the short term, people are struggling, people can't afford, the prices are way too high, people can't afford food. And there's no more money we can give. What do we do for individual people? Like how can the government intervene there?
So what you're asking, Damien, is what the government can do. The government can print money. And so it's not that the government can't print money anymore or can't issue debt because interest rates are too high. The government has a central bank, and the government can tell the central bank, create brand new money and buy all the treasuries and get the interest rates down. Buy so many treasuries that you're actually creating artificial scarcity for them and get the interest rates down. The government has the tools to do this. That's why mandating banks or making the laws around that the banks have to have this amount of Bitcoin and they can only lend 10 times the amount of Bitcoin in reserve, that's not free market either. Free market is a bank having reserves, publishing those reserves, and then having their deposit rates reflect what type of reserve ratio they have. A government should have the ability to have its own currency so that it can print its own currency if it needs to. There are thousands of examples of this through time. And like if you go back 2,000 years and you have a silver coin, your let's say the Roman Empire, you have a silver coin. The silver coin is what you use to pay your soldiers, right? And you're out of money. You're out of money as a government. And you have soldiers to pay. Well, you can go out and tax and then melt down all the coins and then make them one third as thin and give them to the soldier and say, here's your salary. And the soldier will say, hey, this is one third the metal. And the government says, yeah, but it says one silver coin on it. And they're like, but it's not one silver coin, it's one third. And the government's like, no, it says one on it. You're devalued. And that's how the government gets away with it, is that they devalue. That's what you do when you create more currency, when you print, you are physically devaluing your currency because you're creating more of it where it didn't exist in the past. But the government has the tool to do that. What will be the result, Damien? Higher prices, right? Prices will go up, but at least the people will have the money to pay for some of it. And if the government can stay ahead, then they stay in power. And if they don't, they get kicked out by the people. So there's also examples going back thousands of years of how inflation itself has ended governments because the government spent too much, the currency devalued, the people got mad, they revolted, and they kicked the government out. So we have lots of examples of that in history as well.
Mm. So should Bitcoin exist alongside a government-issued currency? Is it not meant to replace a government-issued currency?
I would say yes. I really do believe that. I believe Bitcoin is an asset that will exist. I believe that government currencies can be a lot more sound. Right now, they're completely broken. My first book was about that. The second book is going to go a lot deeper into why the dollar is so broken. It just doesn't really resemble a sound currency in any way. There's a lot of reasons for that, but it doesn't resemble that. There are ways for governments to recapture sound currency, and honestly, they don't have anything to do with gold or Bitcoin. It's just their own fiscal house, right? And their own monetary practices and all of that, and their relationship with their banking system, because the banks are the ones that are also allowed to create the currency. So there's an interesting dynamic. If the government lets banks create the currency, does the government really control the currency? It's tricky, right? It's not easy. It's not black and white. It's not easy to say. Yes, they regulate the banks and the Fed regulates the banks. But if the banks can just do something in the middle of the month before their reporting period, does the government really control the issuance of currency in the United States? I would argue it doesn't, right? And so it doesn't fully control it. So how a government currency system can operate in a sound way has nothing to do with gold or Bitcoin.
Okay.
And from a political science perspective, Damien, it makes sense to have your own currency, full stop.
Okay.
Right? And so if that is true, does it make sense to have your own currency that then is tied to a commodity? Or would it make more sense to have one that's not tied to a commodity so that you can use it for your own benefit without being handcuffed by the commodity? Excellent stuff, man. Really good conversation today.
I learned a lot from this, and I may have more questions than when I started with, but thank you. This is a great conversation for me.
Phenomenal. Okay, Damien, thanks again for joining us today, and we'll catch you guys next time.